you know, it's not an overstatement to say American healthcare is broken. I think, you know, 30 years ago, that was a controversial statement. Today, I think it's now accepted as a truism. And, you know, at the time, it was really just about learning about why it's broken. And you need to have a language to be able to talk about both the problems and also the solutions. And I think business school actually gave me that. But, you know, I think it like medical school, it's really just a vocabulary class. And, you know, it's the experiences that came after that that I think really have shaped my perspective on, you know, what really needs to be done to solve our biggest problems in healthcare.
Welcome back to Pop Health Podcast. This is your host, Zach Morgan. We're so excited to have you with us today. We're glad that you've joined us for our conversation with Dr. Sachin Jain, the CEO of Care More Health, an integrated health plan located in Southern California and serving 10 states. Dr. Jain receives his MBA from Harvard Business School and his doctorate from Harvard Medical School before going to work for the government under President Obama, where he worked to implement programs such as the High Tech Act and helped organize the creation of CMMI, the Center for Innovation. Now serving as CareMore's CEO, he is hoping to radically improve the way that patients receive care, and we're excited to share this conversation with you. Thanks again for joining us. So Sachin, as we like to start off each episode, can you tell the audience something about you that may be surprising or maybe something outside of the workplace, a hobby, fun fact?
Yeah, I think I'm a glutton for punishment. I just became a homeowner, and I don't recommend it to anyone. That is my fun fact.
What have been maybe some of the challenges of homeownership?
Everything. Everything looks good when you buy it, and then it's broken the moment that you move in. So I don't have a refrigerator, working air conditioning. These are all things that I'm working through right now.
Woo! So. And I'm guessing it's relative to where we're recording today, which is in Cerritos, California.
I live in Playa del Rey. So I just moved there recently and love the house, but hate the house. So, hopefully many of the listeners can relate to this experience.
I'm actually an LMU alumni, so I know Playa del Rey very, very well. It's a great area over there.
Yes, there's a lot to be said about the area, but at the same time, I think this house right now is causing a lot of heartache. So,
so let's jump into a little bit about your background. So you received your undergrad degree from Harvard in government before completing your MD and MBA. What was your motivation or interest in government studies?
Yeah, you know, I was someone who is always interested in public policy. I was, you know, these kind of big questions about, you know, how do you make society better were things that got me, you know, very fired up from an early age. You know, a lot of people play, you know, catch with their dad. My routine activity with my father was actually watching the nightly news and then talking about it afterwards. And I think from that, I had a lot of interest in the topics that were being discussed in the news. And many may not remember a time when we actually talked about public policy in this country as opposed to kind of the salacious details of politics. And so I just got very interested in policy I think saw myself, you know, at that early age as someone who would participate in the development and shaping of American public policy.
May I ask if your father was involved at all in?
He wasn't actually. I mean, he's just a physician, not just a physician. He's a physician, an academic pain management physician who I think, you know, like me, grew up with a father who was interested in, you know, issues of broader importance to the world. And so, you know, I think his influence really shaped me quite a bit in that way.
Very neat. Well, I hope he's listening or will be listening.
He will be listening. He will be listening.
All right. Very good. Well, nice shout out to your father there.
Thanks.
So you went to Harvard for your MD and your MBA. And was that always your intention to be both on the medical side and business side?
It wasn't actually. I mean, like I said, I thought I would start out in policy. And I thought it originally actually applied to both medical school and then public policy graduate school. And it was only kind of in the middle of my training that I actually did a research project with a professor named Dr. David Blumenthal, He was studying healthcare through the lens of the American presidency. And he had asked me to actually research the healthcare policy of George Bush Sr.
Yeah.
And when I realized that the exact same kind of public policy advocates were saying the same thing in 1988 as they were saying in 1998, as they were saying in 2004, it kind of, a bulb went off in my head that, you know, maybe the best way to change American healthcare wasn't through the lens of public policy, because public policy, major changes and shifts in public policy happen infrequently
right. In
this country. And so I started to see a new breed of physician leaders in Boston. The time, Mass General Hospital and Brigham and Women's Hospital both installed new CEOs who had interesting letters behind their names. They were MD, MBAs, and I'd never seen that before.
Yeah.
And so I went to go see Peter Slavin, who was leading the Mass General, and I went to see Gary Gottlieb, who was leading the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And both encouraged me to think about business school as a way to better understand clinical operations, better understand finance. And they impressed upon me the possibility that as someone who is clinically trained as well as trained in business, that I would be able to make a big difference in American healthcare. And so having had some public policy training under my belt already because of my undergraduate degree, I decided to go to business school instead of medical school. And it was an amazing experience. It was something I recommend to anyone. Anyone who asks me about it, I say, if you're thinking about it, just do it.
Yeah.
Because I think it really rounds out your perspective and training as a physician and as a leader. So I really think it was very formative for me.
Good. Can you give any examples of how having been trained on both sides, on the business side, on the medical side, has maybe given you an advantage in your career? Anything specific?
Well, it actually just teaches you a completely different language. I mean, medical school teaches you the language of physiology, pathophysiology, clinical care, but it doesn't teach you a language around the structure and organization of healthcare delivery. And those are really two very different disciplines. And I think there's a public perception that you learn about structure and operations and process when you're, training to be a physician, but you really don't. You learn how to take care of people, which is an invaluable skill, and we need people who do that. But at the same time, I think, it's not an overstatement to say American healthcare is broken. I think, 30 years ago, that was a controversial statement. Today, I think it's now accepted as a truism. At the time, it was really just about learning about why it's broken. And you need to have a language to be able to talk about both the problems and also the solutions. And I think business school actually gave me that. But, I think it like medical school, it's really just a vocabulary class. And, it's the experiences that came after that I think really have shaped my perspective on, what really needs to be done to solve our biggest problems in healthcare. But at least it gave me a language to talk about it.
Right, right. Well, and then after that, you actually went to work for David Blumenthal in the government. I was going to ask how that association came around, but apparently it was Professor Blumenthal before that. So he was the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. Was that association how you began your government career, or how?
Yeah,
you
no, it was today? It was interesting. I mean, you heard about my kind of early interest in shaping American public policy, and then kind of my realization that it wasn't going to be a part of my path. And then all of a sudden, President Obama was elected with, I think a mandate to change healthcare in this country. And very soon after he was elected, many of the folks who were my mentors, who had shaped my career as a student, were being rumored to join the administration. And, it was people like Howard Koh and Don Berwick and David Blumenthal, Arnie Epstein. And so kind of one by one, I reached out to each of these folks and I said, I will do whatever you ask me to do because I want to be a part of this. And I will carry your bags. I will take your notes. I will do whatever you ask me to. And the first person who called was David Blumenthal. I joined him in December of 2009. This was off the heels of the passage of the High Tech Act, for listeners who are unfamiliar with it, was the federal legislation that was part of the Recovery Act to promote the meaningful use of health information technology in this country, better known as really the subsidy program around electronic health records. And so there was just, a tremendous lift necessary. We were essentially a startup agency, and ONC had been founded in the Bush administration, but was really a very small agency, and we needed to scale up to really deliver on the promise of this program. And so I just loved it. I mean, it was, you know, a real highlight of my professional career. It's something I'm going to remember for a long time. And I just built amazing relationships and friendships. And, you know, government service is something, you know, I would recommend to anyone in the listening audience, Republican, Democrat. I think it's just, it's something that is really important and something that, you know, we should all spend some time doing.
So you touched a little bit on the HITECH Act, and I think people don't necessarily think about what an impact it has on modern healthcare, but also how recently it's become necessary and really essential to day-to-day workings of the healthcare industry. I was just going to ask, can you tell us a little bit about the implementation itself? Because we know healthcare is pretty set in its ways. So how did rolling something like that out go?
Yeah, I mean, I think to really appreciate the impact of the HITECH Act, you have to kind of take yourself back to, you know, 2008 or 2007 and walk the halls of any American hospital and realize that the primary mode of actually capturing and transmitting information was the same that it was in the time of Hippocrates. It was paper and pencil and paper and pen. And, you know, the iPhone came out in 2007. So if you think about the fact that, you know, it's 2008 and we're something as important as the delivery of healthcare, we're using paper and pen and the number of errors that that could potentially introduce and the limitations as far as being able to capture, collect, and analyze data was pretty profound. And so, you know, I think we were largely lagging behind the rest of the economy. There's a lot of reasons why we never implemented electronic health record systems in doctors' offices and hospitals. And you know, I would say first among those was the economic disincentive. There was no one who was actually going to fund the implementation of these relatively expensive systems. That's just not how payment in American healthcare really works. And so I think there was a lot of wisdom to try to create a federal stimulus program that would build a whole new industry, an ecosystem around health information technology and data. Now, I think, you know, most of us who worked in that time, you know, feel like we didn't do as much as we could have. Interoperability never really took flight. But what has happened is that we've gone from a place where, you know, maybe 14 or 15% of American medicine was actually using electronic health record systems to a place where now 80 to 90% of it doctors and hospitals are using those types of systems. And I think what you're now seeing is the ecosystem building around that of capabilities that can really drive improvements in clinical care. And I think what you're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years is the benefits of these investments that were made, you know, 10 years ago. I think that these systems have created a lot of frustration. And I will say, you know, my work with the electronic health record industry left me pretty disappointed. I feel like that industry really developed in isolation of physicians to support billing and payments and not really support clinical care. But I think, you know, there's a lot of course correction happening right now. So I'm in a place of greater optimism than I have been in a long time.
That's great. So I have to make a small caveat before we keep going here, because we're going to keep talking about some of these things, but you're very active on LinkedIn. I would encourage the listeners to check out your LinkedIn page if they haven't already. But you had a post a while ago that something that we are guilty of, you listed some terms that are tired as buzzwords in healthcare. And I'm certainly guilty and probably will be guilty as we continue this podcast. But some of them included innovation, value-based transformation, population health. Can you just explain?
Yeah, I'm like a recovering, you know, healthcare innovation junkie. I mean, and you know, and so part of my kind of tweeting and posting about those terms is really therapy for myself. Just because I think we all underestimate the challenge. We all, you know, believe it if we can just, you know, kind of be a little bit smarter than everyone who came before us, that everything's going to be better. And that's not really the case. I mean, the reason that we are where we are isn't because people weren't smart or committed or dedicated or didn't want to do the right things. It's because the game hasn't been set up in the right way. And so, you know, I think that there's a language that's evolved that, frankly, I think has obscured what we're really trying to do, which is to just make healthcare better. And we make ourselves feel better with terms like population health and innovation and transformation. You know, it's not a language that really resonates with the people who are actually delivering care, the front lines of American healthcare. And, you know, so there's this innovation industry that almost lives in isolation of the people who are on the front lines of care delivery. And so part of my mission, honestly, is to close that gap. Part of what I'm hoping to do is to get these worlds talking to each other. And language actually matters a lot. I think I've had many teachers who've impressed that upon me. But I think, you know, probably the most important among those was my predecessor here at CareMore, which is Leba Lesson, who, told me about the importance of actually speaking plainly and not using the jargon. Because at the end of the day, what patients really want is to be cared for. It's the reason that we all do what we do. And I think a lot of this language obscures the true essence of why we're all in this.
Yeah, I very much relate to that, and we need to do a better job.
Yeah, no, the sociology matters so much, and the psychology matters so much, and the leadership dynamics matter so much. And I think all of those subjects are a little bit underplayed in our industry, and we tend to look for easy solutions and easy fixes. Or we tend to believe that change needs to take, 10 decades, that, we just need to bring everyone along. That's one of my least favorite expressions, in organizations is, we need to just bring everyone along. Whereas I think we need to I think we need to reflex more back to a place of moral authority where we just have to do the right thing. And people will line up when you are doing the right thing. Where they don't line up is when, when you fail to actually articulate the why. But the right thing resonates with people who matter, which are the people who deliver care and the people who receive care.
Right, right. So buzzwords or tired buzzwords aside, you were instrumental in with the High Tech Act, and so obviously very involved in technology. Is there technology coming in healthcare that does particularly excite you?
Yeah, I'm really interested in the boring stuff. And what I mean by that is, a lot of this is informed by my very close and direct contact with the patients and members of CareMore who, write to me and email me and call me periodically. They all have my phone number as well as my email address. And so when things get really bad, they reach out to me. And what you realize is that there's a lot of simple process in healthcare that could be a lot better. Any one of us who has received healthcare has received an explanation of benefits. What does that explanation of benefits really mean, right? I mean, it's a regulatory document that means nothing to the patient at the end of the day. And so I'm really interested in taking these simple annoyances that actually all add up to create a lot of abrasion for patients and members and just making them better. Creating a consumer experience where it takes one call to actually resolve your issue or your problem. Right before I joined this podcast, I was on the phone with Amazon, and it was probably, it was probably my fourth call to Amazon in the last couple of weeks. And I was very disappointed about this particular call because in every previous call, they had resolved the issue in a single call. And this was, an issue that was now going to require multiple calls. Think about what we do in healthcare in terms of actually the number of calls we require of patients to get things done. Simple systems like, creating a ticket for a patient complaint to make sure that that ticket gets resolved, something that seems like 20-year-old news in healthcare, in IT rather, is a new concept in healthcare. It's totally novel and people think it's exciting. And I'm just really excited about getting the basics right. And I think, there will be AI and there's going to be a lot of new digital tools and remote monitoring is going to go from, 1.0 to 2.0 to 3.0. Pick your favorite 0.0. The reality is that if we can just get these simple interactions with healthcare better, we're going to make a big difference for patients. And, we're going to make healthcare what it should be, which is something that embraces you, something that actually is there for you when you need it and that you feel good about, even when things aren't going well for you. And that's the aspiration. That's where we're trying to take things.
Sure, sure. What about in your own personal life? Well, if an app disappeared off of your phone, which one would make the biggest impact in your day-to-day?
Oh, that's a really good question. The simple answer is, Safari or Chrome. I'm not a huge app user. It's not where I love to spend my time. I think that, in fact, one of our biggest challenges right now is that we are getting too digital. We are spending too much time staring at our screens. And, you know, I think I probably would be relieved if all of my apps disappeared, to be super honest with you.
Sure, sure. Some of your followers online, maybe not so much. So just getting back into the bigger picture a little bit, you actually were also a part of founding an organization that we have a lot of experience with as well, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, sure. CMMI.
Yeah.
So what made that program different, and what did you hope to accomplish when you founded it, or when you helped found it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's probably... one of the most exciting things I was ever a part of, if not the most exciting thing I was ever a part of. I mean, we were given $10 billion over 10 years. It actually refreshes every 10 years, so there will be another $10 billion, provided Congress continues to authorize it, to actually implement programs that improve quality and reduce cost. And it does something that was very unique and I think very special at the time, which is that it actually gave the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and by proxy, the administrator of CMS, the authority to scale anything that actually accomplished the goal of improving quality and reducing cost to the entire Medicare program. I think that was just an incredible, incredible piece of legislation, Section 3021 of the ACA, because it actually took a lot of bureaucratic process that ordinarily would have gone back to Congress. And just handed the power and the authority to CMS. It used to be that if you wanted to change the Medicare program, it really literally acted and it required an act of Congress. And it just gave a lot more authority to, you know, the bureaucracy of the agency, to actually take results from pilots that were certified by the actuary and, you know, scale them. Now, I think, you know, there's a lot of work done up front to try to define, you know, what success looked like. And, you know, the CMMI was actually not a new concept. I think most people think it was a new concept, but it was actually kind of a replacement for ORDI, which was the research and development arm of CMS that actually initially presented data back to Congress and Congress would then act on. So, you know, it kind of grew out of ORDI. And ORDI, you know, is probably one of the most influential things in American healthcare that no one's ever heard of. Things like DRGs came out of demonstrations that ORDI did in the 1980s. Wow. I think that the idea of creating an R&D lab within CMS was fantastic. Now, you know, what would I give all of us who kind of worked on it as far as a grade, you know, years later? It was probably a B. I think there have been some really great initiatives that have come out of it. One of the things I'm personally proud of, having spearheaded from the very beginning, was the diabetes prevention initiative that kind of came out of CMS. That was because of some early pilot work that we chartered there. And so the fact that we now have a diabetes prevention benefit really came out of CMMI. But I think that there was too much of a focus on payment and structure and not enough of a process on disease. This was an early debate that I lost. I think there was a huge focus on, you know, how do we get the structures right? So there was focus on bundled payments, focus on ACOs. There wasn't as much focus really on what are the five most significant diseases in this country and what are the delivery models that are actually going to make those diseases get better. And so that's where I think, you know, there was not enough of a clinical voice, at CMS. I still think that there's an opportunity for there to be a greater clinical voice at CMS. You know, I think Patrick Conway provided that, in addition to Rick Gilfillan, but I think, you know, they were a few people in a much larger bureaucracy. And frankly, we had a lot of, you know, political pressures from other parts of HHS, the White House. And so, you know, a lot of the things that came out of CMMI weren't always necessarily, you know, I think driven necessarily by CMMI. They were driven by a lot of external pressures. And so, you know, when I give it a B, it's a B in the context of all of those, you know, I think external forces and external pressures. But what I think is most exciting about it is the fact that it is a persistent apparatus that we now have to make care better. And one of the things that I think is really exciting about it is that it's very bipartisan. You know, of all the parts of the ACA that are controversial, that, you know, draw ire from Republicans, Democrats, CMMI is almost protected from it, you know, largely because I think people recognize that we do need a National Institutes for Healthcare Delivery. We do need a system that allows us to actually take the Medicare and Medicaid programs and continuously iterate and make them better. And when you have that, you then create some of the innovation that then the private sector actually follows onto and gloms onto. And that was one of the, I think, key roles that I played when I was at HHS, which was to try to create as much private sector alignment as possible. Because as soon as the government moves in a direction, there's the possibility for the private sector to double down on some of the initiatives that you create and create even more momentum in the marketplace. And so I think there's just, you know, I think CMMI is one of the most exciting, you know, forces for good. I think Adam Bowler is doing some great work there right now in the Trump administration. So, I think, we're in a place where this is now seen not as a Republican thing, a Democrat thing. It's a bipartisan lab for making healthcare better, which was really sorely needed.
Yeah. You bring up an interesting point, because even though it is this bipartisan idea and it's something that has the auto renewal, it did come up in discussions as potentially being on the chopping block based on how the new administration moved forward. So you have maybe a more acutely aware perspective of how this goes. How do you manage long-term change over different administrations or over different partisan ideas that come into power?
Yeah, I don't have any special sauce as it relates to managing that change. It's just part of working in a highly regulated and government-funded industry like ours. And I think, lots of opportunities created by actions taken by the government and lots of opportunities taken away by actions taken by the government. And that's as long as, we have, government funding for healthcare, that's going to be a part of the landscape in which we operate.
How do private companies, like you said, alignment of private companies helps push, government initiatives forward. How can private companies affect some of that change? If it's moving in one direction and then there's talk of going in another direction, how can private industry help?
Yeah. So a lot of it is by not duplicating infrastructure and harmonizing standards. So, I think the best example of this is that, during the High Tech Act, there were federal incentives, but there were actually private sector incentives that were in place for a long time around adoption and use of electronic health information. One of the worst things when you're somebody who delivers care is having to deal with three different standards from three different payers. You've got what CMS asks you to do, you've got what payer X wants you to do, and then you've got what payer Y wants you to do. And if you're 90% in alignment with what the public sector, is driving, then, you can give up your 10% of variation in terms of your own program and just follow on with what the government program is. And one of, I think, the most exciting things I was a part of was a series of announcements at the National Press Club. I think this was in 2015, where, eight or 10 different entities from the private sector stood alongside, us as federal policy officials and created programs that were in clear alignment. And we actually had a paper in Health Affairs that if anyone's interested, they can look up on kind of how to think about this and how to do this.
Excellent. So we're going to take a quick break and come back. We want to dive into your work here at CareMore, but we'll be back after a short break.
Welcome everyone back from the break. So Suchin, can you tell us about your role here as CEO of CareMore Health Plan, and specifically how an integrated health plan is different from a traditional health plan?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I have one of the best jobs in American healthcare. I think, the marriage of payment and the delivery of care enables you to think very differently and holistically about your patients, enables you to think about long-term investments that you can make in actually improving the health and welfare of patients. The average, Anthem CareMore member stays with us for, about 9 years. And so one of the big criticisms of insurance companies when you study them from a health policy perspective is that they're not necessarily making kind of long-term investments in care. But when you're both the delivery organization and the plan, people tend to stay with you longer because their attachment is to the delivery of care, which then enables you to do things like invest in diabetes prevention or invest in transportation benefits to make sure patients get to their appointments, or focus on the problems of senior loneliness and really investing in getting your patients more connected to the community and their well-being. So I think there's just lots of opportunities for us to just think differently about patient care that you wouldn't be able to do if you were just a delivery organization or just a health plan.
And what is the profile of someone, like, who can apply to be a CareMore Anthem or CareMore member?
Yeah, so anyone over the age of 65 or anyone who's disabled, anyone who's actually qualified for Medicare can become a CareMore member. CareMore operates a number of special needs plans, chronic special needs plans, and institutionalized special needs plans. So if someone suffers from a chronic disease, they can become a member of our diabetes plan or our heart plan. If someone suffers, if someone is homebound or institution bound, they can be part of our iSNP plan, which is called CareMore Touch or Anthem Touch, which enables us to make a weekly visit to the patient and really do everything we can to keep them at home and well and out of the hospital. And so, you know, it's really anyone who qualifies for Medicare.
Great. Very good. Also, so Medicare Advantage plan.
Exactly.
For those of you who may not be familiar. Very good. So CareMore rose to prominence, excuse me, for being buzzword innovative, excuse me, specifically for managing chronic diseases, which you touched on a moment ago. Can you tell us about this model of managing chronic disease and maybe how it's been successful?
Yeah, I mean, we've taken a broadly multidisciplinary approach to managing our patients and managing their care that doesn't traditionally exist within most doctor's offices. Most doctor's offices are set up today in 2018 the same way that they were set up in 1958. People come in for standardized visits. They're given a prescription. They're given instruction. And they're not given a lot of support that they actually need to actually manage their overall conditions. And the reality is that, you know, we specialize in taking care of people with multiple chronic diseases, diabetes, congestive heart failure, COPD, depression, behavioral health. And that requires a truly multidisciplinary approach. And so if you come to a CareMore Care Center, you'll have access to a nurse practitioner who actually focuses on chronic disease management by using protocols that we've developed over a number of years. You've got access to nutrition and diet counseling, exercise facilities that are focused on the senior population. We call them Nifty After 50.
Nice.
You've got access to behavioral health coaches who can help you manage your, you know, honestly, a lot of the denial that comes with having chronic disease.
Yeah.
That I think stands in the way of people actually getting the care that they need. And so, you know, when you build that multidisciplinary model, it really enables people to do better. And, you know, we measure our success by the extent to which our patients stay out of the hospital. We view every hospital admission, nearly every hospital admission, as a failure of our system to effectively manage the care of patients as an outpatient. Obviously, if you need a surgical procedure, an elective, you know, a knee replacement, you'll have a short stay in the hospital. But lots of things that people are going to the hospital for are the result of poorly managed, you know, care up front. And so, you know, our model is really focused on, you know, enveloping our patients with the kind of care that they need to stay well.
Very good. So you guys have had some success. Some folks can Google it if you'd like to see some of the results of CareMore managing this high risk population and what maybe previously was high cost population. Why haven't other health plans been able to duplicate the success or gone after or maybe even tried to replicate it?
Yeah, I mean, I think they have. Okay. You know, I think the CareMore model is, you know, 25 years old now. It's well known. I think, you know, the reality is that it requires radical common sense. It requires kind of suspending disbelief around a lot of the things that we take as truisms in American healthcare. It requires thinking very differently about every aspect of how a health plan is organized and operated. It requires doing the same thing on the delivery side. And, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, to our previous conversation are really interested in incremental change, and they're interested in being in celebrating, you know, innovation that's not really innovation. They're interested in, you know, making marginal improvements and saying that they're bigger than they are. And what the CareMore model requires is a fundamental rethinking of primary care, how it operates and structure, the role of specialists. And you know, in our view, confident generalists are the center of healthcare. When my father was unfortunately hospitalized last year with a bout of salmonella, he ended up getting 9 specialist consults for a single problem. And so when you think about, you know, the overutilization of services, the number of tests that we put patients through unnecessarily because of how we organize and structure care and how we pay for care, you know, we really put people through the ringer. And so, you know, to use a buzzword, this is a disruptive model. This is not a model that, you know, neatly works in the status quo. It requires you to think differently about care. And so, you know, we are scaling at this point. You know, we were in 2006, we had one care center in Southern California. Today, we have 64 care centers in 10 states, you know, covering over 150,000 patients.
Can you remind the audience what states those are in?
Absolutely. California, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, Virginia, Iowa, Tennessee, Washington, D.C., Texas, and Connecticut.
Congratulations.
Those are our 10 states.
Nice.
And, you know, we're going to be creating a, you know, greater presence even within the states that we're in. You know, we grew up originally as a Medicare Advantage organization, but we now, the principles that we've used to take care of Medicare Advantage patients can really be applied to take care of high cost, high need Medicaid patients, as well as commercial patients. And so where we're taking care more over time is actually very interesting. We're not just going to be working with, you know, the Anthem Care More health plan. We will be making ourselves available through other health plans as well. So our delivery model will become a part of the networks of other health plans, and you'll hear some announcements about that later this year. And we're also going to be working across multiple populations, Medicaid and commercial. Again, because what we're doing here, this sort of common sense clinical care model, ultimately works across all populations. It really does. It needs to be, you know, tailored a little bit. And we've now seen these robust results replicate over multiple markets. And I think that's, you know, something that, you know, needs to happen more.
Yeah. You mentioned Medicare Advantage. How has the heavy shift towards Medicare Advantage been specifically beneficial to care more and your ability to care for the entire person?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Medicare Advantage that's different from fee-for-service Medicare is that the federal government is essentially delegating responsibility for all medical expenses to a health plan. And what it enables you to do is to come up with benefit design that really implements common sense, providing transportation to members, covering insulin through the donut hole. Those are things that CareMore does that, you know, patients don't otherwise have access through the traditional Medicare program. And as I think more and more people enroll in Medicare Advantage plans, they're, you know, that the benefits of that radical common sense, you know, trading off kind of the broad network of traditional Medicare for a narrower network, but a richer benefit structure within MA, I think is going to create even more growth in the Medicare Advantage space. And so, you know, it's an opportunity for us to serve more patients and make an even bigger difference in American healthcare. So we're very optimistic about it and really looking forward to it.
Something that we're particularly excited about, CMS recently announced that Medicare Advantage plans are going to be able to begin including supplemental benefits into their plans for those Medicare Advantage members. Has CareMore considered implementing any of those supplemental benefits and just kind of on a larger scale?
Yeah, we're not able to talk about specific benefits at this point because, but it's absolutely something we've considered and something that we're working on.
How about How about on a larger scale? How those things, adult daycare, meals, non-medical care, those kind of non-clinical needs that aren't typically included, how on a larger scale, how can those really affect the Medicare Advantage population? As you were saying, that it allows you to focus on the whole picture.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, so much of health is not about medicines, and it's not about diagnostic tests, and it's not about procedures. So much of health is about, you know, your connection to society, you know, whether your daily needs are being met, whether you feel up to waking up every morning. And the sad reality is that many patients don't. And so, you know, sometimes the best way to care for people is to actually care for them and provide for some of their non-medical needs. And I think some of that added flexibility is going to enable health plans to really take that broader view of what patients need, what human beings need, forget patients, what human beings need to be well and to stay well. I think the best example of that is some of the work that we're doing on social isolation. You know, there's a lot of kind of rival health plans putting out press releases about the fact that they've identified loneliness as a problem in America. A year before those press releases came out, CareMore was actually working on a program, implementing a program. We call it our Togetherness program. It's far more catchy than our loneliness program. to really focus on addressing the needs of our most socially isolated seniors. And, you know, the results from that are dramatic. We've seen a 75% increase in the level of social engagement and participation in our Nifty After 50 gyms. We've seen 5% reductions in overall healthcare costs. We've seen 10% reductions in hospitalization rates, you know, as compared to control groups, when you do focus on this issue of social isolation. And so, you know, we have this, I think, incredible opportunity to start thinking differently about what is health and what is healthcare. And again, I think once the regulatory environment, you know, starts to recognize that as well, I think you're going to start to see a lot of innovative organizations. CareMore is one of them, but a lot of other innovative organizations start to think differently about their role in the ecosystem.
Excellent. Well, that's all we have for today. Thank you so much for giving us your time. It's been really informative and interesting to talk to you, and we are sure the audience is going to like it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.